From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Digital technology has reshaped societies all over the world. Broadband internet access is now considered akin to a human right. Our smartphones allow us to carry mini computers wherever we go. And many of us imagine that these conveniences help streamline our busy lives. But more often than not, we are spending inordinate amounts of time in front of screens. Worse yet, our children are doing so, encouraged by schools and parents alike. Some analysts have warned of technology's negative impact on our society. Today, we turn to a psychologist who's not averse to digital devices, but who advocates for finding a balance, something I suspect most of us are craving direction on. Doreen Dodgen-McGee is a psychologist with over 25 years of experience and author of the new book, Deviced, Balancing Life and Technology in a Digital World. Welcome to the program, Doreen.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored.
So this book, of course, caught my attention quite a bit, as I imagine many of us who live in our modern lives might want to sort of, wonder if we can find this balance. Most of us probably feel guilty about how much time we spend in front of screens and suspect we're spending too much time in front of our screens, but don't necessarily know where to start. What led you down this path as a psychologist to think about how much time we spend in front of devices and why we need a balance?
Well, I really became interested when I noticed when my own children were middle school age, flip phones were starting to, enter the scene. And as a psychologist who very firmly believes the research that shows that our brains are most healthfully wired by learning within an environment where we have a rich variety of experiences and also a rich ability to encounter a variety of other individuals, that the interpersonal interactions that we have really do create the wiring in the brain, I started to wonder about how these small devices were going to change some developmental trajectories. So about 15 years ago, I got interested in thinking, how can I be ahead of this a little bit and watch what happens? And kind of look at the peer-reviewed research as well as pop culture trends. And sure enough, I began to see how in America, our fascination with whatever is new and shiny leads us to kind of overuse most things that are exciting. So I began to kind of look at how our overuse or our over-reliance was really coming out to impact us in the research. And it does appear now that there are four areas of impact, that our excessive use of technology is impacting our brains, literally the way our brains wire. It's affecting the scaffolding upon which we build relationships. And then it's changing the way that we kind of interact with our own selves, so our own kind of sense of self and our relationship with ourselves. And then the fourth thing that is appearing pretty consistently in the research is that it is impacting the way in which we experience our body out and about in the world. That we, as we have more and more experiences in digital spaces, and as those experiences become more immersive, we are not tending to our own physical bodies as much, and there's a profound cost we pay for that.
Let's talk about children. That is so critical because children are have developing brains, but they're also today increasingly in schools at a very young age being given tablets instead of textbooks. What does the research say about the impact of digital technology on the brains of children? And, is some of the most scary sounding research really true? I mean, do you believe it? Is there, what's really going on with children's brains? Because if you listen to some people, digital technology will cause your brain to rot. And maybe that's true, and maybe it's not.
Right. So I think we always have to be very careful and look at the research with a really keen eye toward good quality, well-constructed, designed studies that we can rely upon. And I think that's a big thing to start with.
Right. But correlation is not causation.
Exactly. And overall, I think the thing that I would say is that we know that the brain wires together wherever it fires together, meaning that whatever we expose our brains to creates electrical circuitry in the brain that allows us proficiency at dealing with those situations we have, you know, exposed our brains to. And what I'm concerned about is that, and I think other researchers as well, is that we are no longer naturally offered opportunities for boredom or for the we're not forced anymore in our daily lives to become resourceful with our own cognitive processing. You know, if we have a question, we can just Google the answer. If we're standing in line and bored, we can just pull out our smartphone or our tablet. And what that does is that means we are never forced anymore. Now, we can create opportunities to expose ourselves to a lack of information or a lack of stimulation. But if we don't actually create those opportunities anymore, it means we are not naturally exposing the brain to the ability to wire the proclivity to handle boredom, not knowing an answer, using our creative invention and deep critical thought to come up with an answer. And so that's why I believe that moderation is important for children's brain health. And you're right, as our schools move more and more toward tablet-based learning and digital learning, which there's plenty of research that shows that stimulation or information gathered on screens is processed differently in the brain than information processed in or presented in other ways. Not always, that's not always a bad thing, but we just do need to be aware of it, that if we want these rich, complex brains that have literally been wired in the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain for all of us and developing for children, that is related to executive function, kind of can we stop and start behaviors? Can we focus on one thing at a time? Can we attune our communication to fit the environment that we're in? If we want to wire that part of the brain, we need to provide opportunities for it to be fired, meaning we've got to sometimes put down the devices and force ourselves in our own embodied spaces and in our own selves to be able to wrestle with information and develop some skills for tolerating a lack of stimulation.
I remember reading research some time ago about how students in a classroom environment retain information and also process it better when they're writing it down by hand than when they're typing it on their computers, which I thought was just so interesting. And, you know, just one small facet of this conversation. Let's talk about relationships, because humans exist to relate to one another. We are social creatures. That is why, you know, human solitary confinement is akin to torture. But it seems as though we sort of built our own solitary confinement these days, communicating with one another through phones. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I'm sort of embarrassed to admit how I might text my husband, who's sitting in the next room, instead of calling out to him, just because it's easier to do so. It's literally sending a message up into a satellite in space and having it bounce back down to him instead of talking to him. How do these devices impact our relationships with one another?
Well, I think that it's important to note, this is another place where we can't, or it would be unwise of me to make global statements. There are some people for whom technology has actually saved them relationally. Sure. People who live autism, you know, diagnosis of autism, or people who live with great amounts of social anxiety. There are fantastic things about the tech. For the rest of culture, I do think that we are losing a lot. One of the things that is profoundly important is that of the 10 and a half hours a day that we now interact with screens, the bulk of that time comes from the time that we used to spend with family talk time, or if we are not, you know, within a nuclear family, talk time with our peers and our community, and also social practice. And those two things build, again, some skills within us to be able to have eye contact, to be able to have awkward encounters with other people, to be able to kind of learn to make mistakes in our own skin out and about in the world and still feel like we have a place there. So if we are, you know, removing ourselves from those really important psychological developmental tasks and instead engaging in most of our social connections or our relational connections in comparative spaces where we're looking for likes or clicks or follows, there really are some things that we're at risk for. And I love how you said earlier that we can't, you know, correlation does not infer causation. We just have our first study out now from the University of Pennsylvania that shows that high amounts of social media use, which at the time was not even a very high amount of use, it was 30 minutes, more than 30 minutes of social media use in more than two or three platforms can actually cause symptoms of depression and anxiety that looks kind of like a fear of missing out relationally. And I think that's really important for us to pay attention to, because if we are now actually causing some mental health difficulties, that's going to be very important for being aware of in terms of how to maybe lessen those or the likelihood of those.
Right. It feels as though social media, I mean, this is just my impression, social media tends to just bring out the narcissists in us.
It does. It does. There's this kind of sense when I talk, especially with young adults and youth, there's this sense of kind of ambient awareness that we are always being watched. So we always need to be very careful in curating how we present ourselves. And it does kind of push a little bit of a sense of narcissistic kind of more awareness about me than about, you know, seeking out how are you. Another interesting dynamic of that is that we tend to rely on the data that we see in social media spaces, you know, the positive posts and things, rather, and that kind of creates this. And when we meet with people, we assume we know how they are, which is kind of a narcissistic trend, rather than actually asking them about how they're doing and what's going on in their lives.
So, Doreen, there are, I'm sure, members of my audience right now who are patting themselves on the back for completely, you know, removing themselves from social media and minimizing the time they spend on their screens. And maybe others who are thinking, I need to just get off social media. I need to get off I need to reduce my computer use and go back to, you know, finding using a flip phone that's not a smartphone. Is this sort of all or nothing approach also unhealthy?
I believe that it is. And we used to talk a lot, and still some people too talk a lot about digital detoxing. And that can be helpful for a short period of time. But my experience with people is that that is not maintainable. We really can't function well in most situations right now in our world without having some proclivity with our devices. And then without also, I think personally, without being able to step away from them. So I really like to think about how can we become moderate with our technology use, using high quality content when we do engage it, watching out for not overusing, and then at the same time, create some fiery opportunities in our embodied lives. That's the thing that I think I find missing for most people, that they have so become used to kind of turning into their screen that they have actually avoided or not tended to their own embodied environment. So if you can have things around your office, your desk, your home, like, you know, small fidget toys that don't require cognitive skill, not like a Rubik's cube, but something like, you know, Legos or kinetic sand or a yo-yo, things that you just can kind of find yourself putting your phone down to interact with, that's always going to help with this kind of moderation. And I really do believe that that's our only hope right now, is that if we can learn to, again, you know, some of the time we would turn toward our devices, instead turn toward our own self and require ourselves to tolerate the boredom, to figure out the answer to the question on our own without Google, we really will find ourselves experiencing more and more negative effects.
I'm a big believer in art therapy, turning to creative work and creating art, especially with one's hands. I know that people who sort of try hard to lose weight or stop smoking often say, do something else with your hands so that you're not putting a cigarette in your mouth or putting snacks in your mouth. So doing the same thing so that you're not holding a smartphone and checking Facebook.
Right. One of the easiest places to start is to do something like get a small journal that's about the size of your smartphone and a little flat pen and put it in the place where your phone usually lives, or put a small flat pebble there. Or there are some companies that make small tins of of putty that you can put in that space. And so when you reach for your phone, you actually encounter something embodied, and just push yourself to spend 1 minute with it before you actually seek out your phone. And small changes like that can actually grow into really beautiful habits that can feed your brain and force wiring into the parts that may have been pruned off.
What advice can you give to parents, going back to the question of children, right? Because we can try these methods of digitally detoxing, or at least moderating and balancing our lives. Children might complain loudly and vociferously if they're not allowed to have complete or free access to their digital devices. And it's hard for parents sometimes to stop and say no.
It is excruciating. I want to start my response by saying I have immense empathy for both parents and children right now, because it is grueling to try to grow up in a home where people are trying to be moderate. You feel different, you feel other. And it's also grueling to try to raise children in a home of moderation, because it's all around us. So the first thing I would say to parents is that first we must take responsibility for the way we've modeled and the tools we have or haven't given our kids. I think that's very important.
That, right, we, you first can't tell your kids that they can't have smartphones if they see their parents on them all the time.
That's right. And so in the book, I use a lot of assessment tools that families can use together. I'm a big believer in family phones rather than everybody having their own phone. We have a bank of four phones, and you get to check this one out, or, you know. And
wow, you can do that.
Yeah.
That's an interesting idea. Like a library.
Right. I also am a big believer that we, as the grown people in the lives of young people, are responsible for offering them fiery, interesting, somewhat risky, edgy experiences. Because if we aren't offering them those in their embodied lives, they will always be able to find them in the digital spaces, and they will always be much better than what we can provide. So we have to, again, model doing these kind of edgy, risky, interesting things, having a wide variety of kinds of people in our homes for our children to encounter, making sure that our homes are welcoming to the entire body, that there are things to smell and touch and taste and experience. You know, I have balance boards all over my house for people to just step onto and play with. And if we can do those things, you know, enrich our embodied lives, make our tech use moderate, be willing to let our kids do proposals, you know, if they really want the next thing or the next access to the next app and we're not sure about it, then they do a proposal about, you know, how am I going to make sure my use stays moderate? What's going to happen if I get over an edge and I find myself, you know, obsessing over this? How can you parents come to me, and how can we work through that appropriately? I think all those ways that we engage in much more complex thinking are going to be much more helpful and useful to children. The one other thing I would love to say is that the other thing that I'm very aware of in talking with youth and young adults is that they find highly violent and highly sexualized content much earlier than anybody ever prepares them for. And it isn't, it's most of the time not that they're seeking it out. It just, anymore, it comes to us. And so anytime your child is going to spend time online, regardless of their age, which I always suggest introducing it as late as possible, and then when you do introduce it, introduce slow-moving, high-quality content. But when you do, you know, hand them this device that gives them access to the world of the internet, even if you think you have put every filter out there, it's really important to say to your children, you know, sometimes on this device, you're going to find things that make you feel really weird and maybe really excited. And you're going to right away have the instinct probably to not want to tell me about it, because you're going to think, oh, maybe that's not right. It's okay to tell me. I get it. And that way you have created this, you know, this, you've set the tone that there are going to be some times that difficult and harmful content is going to come, and that you can be their ally, not that you will be angry and shaming.
Very, very interesting and difficult questions that we're tackling here. One of the things that I think about as we're having our conversation is that a lot of responsibility falls to parents, and there's so much pressure to parent in the right way, but not everyone in our very busy lives has the luxury of doing so. I'm thinking of low-income Americans for whom the devices are now a substitute for television. You used to be television was the cheap babysitter, and now iPads or tablets or phones are. And it's so difficult for working parents sometimes who might be balancing multiple jobs to monitor everything that their kids are exposed to. And I'm wondering if you have any wisdom on that.
I will say that I agree with you. And one of the cultural trends that is very disappointing and disturbing to me is that those with extreme wealth are choosing to send their children to school systems that don't have as much tech because they're beginning to become aware of how much impact it can have. And I would like to spend a lot of energy trying to make that more equitable across the school systems. It is a reality, and this is where I find a lot of people feel very shamed. A lot of parents, you know, we don't know everyone's story, but it's very common for me to be asked in the beginning of an interview, you know, I was at dinner last night and I saw the family next to me. The parents were talking, but all the kids were on their phones. And what do you think of that? And I always say, I think I have immense empathy. It is a real issue. And I think what I would be doing, what I'd love to encourage people to do is if they have the bandwidth and the availability and the willingness, I would invite them to read my book or research other places and then begin to go into places like school systems or community centers or the places where those parents need help and offer to listen first. What kinds of help do they need and what might you be able to offer? I think it's critical. I think it's critical and important, and it's all of our responsibility now because we know this now, it's our responsibility, I think, to work both at that personal level, at the community level, and then also at the legislative level.
I want to go back to adults and how we have grown so increasingly reliant on this technology. There is this sense that we're going to take charge and harness the technology to make our lives better and easier. And we've become, and this is something you talk about in your book, sort of obsessed with data collection, you know, in the same way that Facebook is obsessed with monitoring what we click on, what ads we might look at, or Google is interested in that, we are now obsessed with counting our steps and wearing Fitbits to count that, or, you know, talking to our devices, Alexa, turn on whatever, my television, or buying smart fridges. You know, so specifically on the data obsession issue, does that really make our lives better?
It's a good question. It depends on how we define better. Mm-hmm. So I think some people will say it makes our lives more convenient. It makes our lives more comfortable. It means we can do more. We can be more productive.
I mean, there seems to be an app for everything, for tracking your cycle, for tracking your weight, for...
Yeah. And I believe we pay a cost for that. I really do. I think it causes us to live in this very self-centric place where we're spending a lot of time collecting our own data and analyzing it and looking at it. And that means we lose touch with our own actual self. Mm-hmm. We lose touch with the diversity and the messiness of actual encountered relationship. You know, if we're just connecting with others based on their data, even, which is something like in a social media setting, what they post, or in a video game, their scores.
Again, or the number of likes or followers they have.
Right. We're not forced to kind of become flexible and become kind of what researchers would call gritty or resilience. We lack grit and resilience when we are just dealing only with information and not the kind of reality of the very complex, messy, difficult encounters that build a hardy, grounded person that lives from what I call an internal locus of control, where my information about myself and actually about the world around me is filtered through things like wisdom and discernment rather than only taken by just collecting cold data and trying to analyze it. There's a lot of research now that's showing, and it's just kind of emerging in the field, that's showing that actually tracking sleep trends with things like Fitbits or fitness trackers is actually creating sleep disorders for people.
What?
Because Yeah, because they're relying more on the data, which the device can't tell when you're really sleeping. It's just making some inferences based on movement and heart rate. But they're trying to get that number up, which is actually creating obsessions and anxiety around sleep. And again, this happens for young parents. You know, the new changing tables for young parents have actually a scale, a digital scale built into them, and will send the weight of the child, the heart rate, to a parent's smartphone. And so the parent gets all this data, but doesn't know what to do with it. And it really is creating a very difficult reality for most of us.
And there's a case to be made for tracking one's data if one is trying to achieve something, but there's nothing beats a good old-fashioned paper and pencil to just do it, right?
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
That is true.
So I know you're a psychologist and you examine the behavioral issues and the impacts on our brains, but do you think that those who control the tech industry bear some responsibility? Because one of the reasons why our technology has evolved in the way it has is because it has been shaped to maximize the profits of Mark Zuckerberg and, you know, the CEOs of these companies.
Yes, I believe that wholeheartedly. So I believe there is kind of a sense of personal responsibility that we can act on once we know how this stuff is impacting us. Then there is that communal sense of responsibility of parents, educators, faith leaders, physicians, mental health folks, of educating the people within their communities about some of the harmful effects that will happen if we are overusing. But then I do believe that there is that third level of accountability, which is legislative and corporate. And that's where I'm beginning to kind of invest my time and energy, because we are now allowing big tech to track data in such a way that we really are being manipulated. Many apps now that we download passively, when you download the app, you passively consent to them tracking your location, even if the app isn't open, maybe even accessing your contacts or your microphone. And then that data is used to kind of, push us notifications or suggest things that actually create this kind of manipulative, self-centric loop in our lives. I also think we are creating and we are allowing, because we don't have any legislation or guidelines, corporate guidelines around this, we are allowing the creation of technologies in a more addictive way. And these companies may not be doing that maliciously. However, they do want us to stay engaged because that's how they make a profit. And so we're doing things like, video streaming services now. You can skip the credits that come at the end of a show and at the beginning of the next show. And when you've binged a whole season, it shows you the next season that's or the next show that's something just like it. And these things kind of take away the natural stopping suggestions that we have historically had in life, where we are forced to take a break when we get to the end of the game, or we're forced to go to sleep when the three channels that exist on TV end for 6 hours and we have to just wait. We don't anymore have these natural built-in stops, and instead we're actually now having tech rolled out every day that is more and more immersive and more suggestive of staying attached, as platforms and apps want us to do everything within their own space. In all the major social medias, you can share videos, share photos, send money, receive money. They want to keep us there so that they can, use our data and then sell it to people. So we are not the customer, we are the product, and we pay a price for that.
Finally, I'm wondering, as a psychologist, are our human brains capable of resisting what this brave new world is throwing at us? I mean, are our brains capable of disciplining ourselves in a way that is sustainable, with a technology that we have just not evolved to handle?
Right. I get asked a lot about this because there is certainly, there are a lot of people that feel like our brains are evolving and they've always been evolving. And so we're all going this way. So this isn't a bad thing. We might as well just give into it. And I understand that thinking. However, at the end of the day, we end up in our physical bodies. And right now, if we do just let this technology kind of, actually some people are now calling it, rather than a screen-based culture, they're calling it a screenome. If we let the screenome overtake us and we only engage with tech for our most important processes of thinking, of connecting, we do, at the end of the day, really lose out in our own selves. If we are not some of the time forcing moderation, and that's why I'm so passionate about this topic and I want to speak to as many people as I can to help them say, even a 10-minute break every day, if we can sustain that for 4 to 6 months, the research shows us that kind of a break for something like exercise that gets you into it is to kind of have this free mental space. Can double the gray matter in the regions of the brain that are related to things like boredom tolerance, like being comfortable in our own skin. Those are really important skills. So this, I do think our brains will change because that's what our brains do, they adapt. And at the same time, I feel like it is crucially important, it is an important critical act of resistance to find ways of building in these small moments of nothingness, of boredom, of mindfulness, in order to keep ourselves able to live within the skin within which we live. I think otherwise we're going to be very, very competitive, anxious, depressed people. And the research is, you know, beginning to show some of that.
Doreen, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate the time you've spent with us.
Thank you. I'm really honored.
I'm going to go and do some 10 minutes of mindfulness now.
Wonderful. Great idea.
Right after I finish all my work. Thank you so much again, Doreen. My guest has been Doreen Dodgen-McGee, a psychologist with over 25 years of experience. She's the author of the new book that we've been discussing, Deviced, Balancing Life and Technology in a Digital World. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.